From the West Australian, I'm Ben O'Shea, and this is The West Live.
The West Live.
The West Live.
The West Live. With Ben O'Shea.
I was flicking through the West today when I stumbled across a full-page ad for Clive Palmer's United Australia Party. The ad features a giant photo of Craig Kelly. As if that wasn't terrifying enough, it came with the banner headline that read, "Our next Prime Minister." To be honest with you, I can't work out if that statement is hilarious or horrifying. Maybe a little bit from column A and a little bit from column B. But how close is it to ever being a reality? Look, I reckon there's more chance of Meghan Markle becoming the Queen of England, but it certainly isn't for want of trying. Palmer's party has already spent over $1 million on YouTube ads promoting Kelly, and who knows how much he's spending on social media, mainstream TV, radio and newspapers. But what is Palmer going to get for his money? Well, so far, he's been successful at positioning Craig Kelly as the face of the anti-vaxxer freedom protests. And on that topic, the TGA previously had a crack at the United Australia Party and Kelly for spreading misinformation on COVID. They were distributing incomplete extracts of adverse vaccine event reports to fool people into thinking the jab was far more dangerous than it actually is. Facebook also investigated Kelly and banned him from their platform for a while for spreading misinformation too. And the Australian Skeptics Organisation gave Kelly the annual Bent Spoon Award for being the proponent of the most preposterous piece of pseudoscience this year. Most of this is kind of funny, but it does have a serious side. While the majority of people see Kelly for what he is, a human punchline, there are those who take his ravings at face value. Some even believe them. So with the massive platform Palmer's money has provided, it'll be fascinating to see how Kelly will impact the federal election. He's going to steal votes off someone, but will it be the major parties or the other fringe political outfits? My guess is he'll cannibalise One Nation's vote, which might end up being a good thing. But the worst case scenario is someone like Kelly holding the balance of power, because then we'd all be stuffed. Coming up on the show, Omicron, elections and workplace culture is the talk of Canberra today. And is the WA government doing enough to protect Indigenous culture? But first, let's see what's making news.
The West, the Live. West Live. Making news.
Joining me now is Sunrise correspondent Matt Tenney. G'day, mate.
G'day, mate. Happy Taco Tuesday.
Taco Tuesday. Mm. I could do with a taco.
Had some nachos last night.
Is there such a thing as a breakfast taco?
Oh, I think there can be. Isn't it like huevos rancheros?
Huevos rancheros, yeah. I love a huevos rancheros. How good is our pronunciation?
I know, amazing. Thank you to all our Mexican listeners.
And now let's go straight into this worrying incident in Northbridge. Probably someone on their way to work has had a collision with a car.
Yeah, cyclist has been raced to Royal Perth Hospital. Well, we're told this female cyclist was hit just before 7 o'clock this morning at the intersection of Newcastle and Beaufort Streets. St John Ambulance have told us this woman was breathing and conscious, but she was taken to Royal Perth under priority conditions. Police are investigating, so we're expecting more to come on that one.
Yeah, anytime there's a cyclist v car, you just hate to see it.
Yeah, it's not good, is it? And you've just got to be so careful, don't you? I mean, we don't know the specific circumstances, but to keep that 1 metre distance, Especially when you're overtaking cyclists, just to be mindful of them.
Yeah, be mindful, pay attention, because it's, you know, they're very, very vulnerable out on the road. There's no doubt about that. And now, yesterday we spoke about this sort of mysterious incident in Hilton that landed a man in RPH, a very serious condition. What do we know now?
So, of course, there was that talk, like, was he hit by a car? Was he attacked? It seems what has happened is there has been some sort of altercation after he stepped off a bus. Witnesses found him. They heard his mum crying because his mum had gone to his aid. He was unconscious at one stage, but then regained consciousness. We're told this morning that police are still hunting for a man who's responsible for this attack. That attacker is still on the run. As for the 36-year-old victim, he's in Royal Perth. He's in a critical condition, fighting for life after undergoing surgery. So hopefully he recovers, but he's not in a good way right now.
And do we know if police suspect that the attacker was known to the victim?
Haven't been told that information at this point in time. Obviously, what they have been able to piece together is the timeline of events that led him to being attacked. You know, from getting on the off the bus, they've recreated the whole scenario at the scene in Hilton. But they're obviously still working on the investigation at this point in time and then trying to chase up whoever was responsible. Of course, lots of people have CCTV these days, so they're looking at that, trying to cover the street.
Yeah.
Snook Crescent, it
was. Well, talking about police and how good they are at catching people, the officers who rescued Cleo, who found Cleo and nabbed her alleged abductor, are being honoured today.
Yes, Cleo's heroes are getting a state reception at Government House with the Governor, Kim Beazley. That's happening at 5 o'clock today. It's going to be quite a private reception, we're told. There won't be media inside. They'll be thanked. We're expecting they'll tell some of the stories about finding Cleo. Of course, that 18-day ordeal that she went through and how the police went about finding her. Can you believe it's been 4 weeks? Since we heard that my name is Cleo.
Yeah. 4 weeks. Seems like
4 weeks.
2 weeks ago, it feels like. Four weeks. Wow, a month.
So there's a core group, a small group of officers who actually went into the alleged kidnapper's house who will be honoured. But, of course, there was a wider group working on the
case. They'll all be honoured?
They're going to be honoured. Of course, the focus today will be on those who actually rescued Cleo. But more generally, the police force will be honoured, yes.
Mm. Imagine if any of them aren't vaccinated and then come tomorrow, stood down. Seriously, can you imagine?
I think you've just found an angle.
Oh, we need to watch that one. And talking about vaccination, have we done it? Have we cracked the vaccination milestone?
Some good news. We have cracked the vaccination milestone. We are over the 75% mark. 75.2% to be exact of those of us 12 and over are now fully vaccinated. So
that was a 0.8 or something jump from yesterday.
Yeah. Big jump from yesterday. This is what we find, though.
Yeah.
There must be some sort of delay in loading data over
Maybe
the weekend.
Combined Saturday and Monday.
I think that's
Monday
what's happening.
Saturday and Sunday.
So we're well on our way. Despite Omicron and all that going on, we're getting closer to that 90%. But, of course, when we get to 80%, we're expecting we'll have a date of reopening. Now, the world is watching and waiting for this, what the impact is of this new variant.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, some of the things coming out of South Africa are positive in the sense of, you know, it's not people dying. It's quite mild. I don't know if you saw the video of a doctor in South Africa who she was saying, you know, her patients, very, very mild symptoms. Please don't lock us off from the rest of the world because it's not that bad. But, you know, it will take a couple of weeks for Pfizer to work out whether their vaccine is effective against this particular variant, which is why that whole opening to visa holders from December 1 has been delayed for 2 weeks to give health authorities a chance to work out what we're dealing with here. But, I mean, the health authorities here have said it would be the ultimate Christmas present if this variant is more transmissible but not as potent or deadly, because then you're going to increase your herd immunity. More and more people will catch it, not get that sick, and hopefully that will lead to the end of the pandemic, because we know it will end at some point.
It'll eventually end.
That's how these things work. It's just a matter of when.
Well, the thing I worry about in those early reports out of South Africa that the symptoms have been quite mild is how many of the people who've caught the Omicron variant have previously had COVID, and so maybe it had some sort of immunity already.
That's another thing. Because they have a low vaccination rate.
They have a very low vaccination rate. And so, you know, like you have to wonder about that as well. And if Omicron got into WA where, you know, we don't have any COVID and no one's had it, it could be a very different circumstances.
And also, what is the likelihood if you've already had COVID of getting another strain that soon?
Yeah, I know. So many questions remain unanswered. And now, we're speaking about the police before who are getting honoured. And this is not a police officer getting honoured, but do have some new graduates joining the force.
We do. We have some new canine graduates. Can you believe that the police force has 29 dogs as part of the canine unit?
That seems like a lot.
It's a massive Paw Patrol that we have. So what is fascinating is the class of 2021, the names.
How many dogs were there?
We've got six new dogs.
Ooh.
So it takes 14 weeks to train a dog to be a drug dog, and then 18 weeks for those dogs that you see that just take down the criminals, you know, rip them.
Well, it takes a long time to get them to teach them how to operate the tasers and stuff like that.
Some people, it takes a while to get your dog to sit even. So these ones are amazing. Here are their names: Ace, Roger, Boogie, Hank, Leo, and Henry.
Hang on.
Would you like to go through them
again? There's a real variation.
Ace.
I like it. That, to me, is like a dog that's going to solve some crimes.
Roger.
Questionable.
But I mean, it's surely would it be confusing when you're like, Roger, you know, on the walkie-talkie? Yeah, exactly. That would be confusing. Boogie.
Yes, okay.
I just can't wait for him to, like, arrest someone at night or something, and then we'll have Boogie Nights.
Boogie, to me, seems like the dog that's going to emerge as the pop culture kind of, you know, phenomenon. Like, there's been, what, Storm, I think, Mesmer.
Yeah, yeah, past, so it'll be, like, police dog Boogie has...
celebrity police dog. Hank?
Hank, it sounds very American, doesn't it? Speaking of which, Leo.
Yeah, all right. Are they all German Shepherds? Is that what they are?
I was trying to look into this. I don't think all of the dogs... No, I don't think they're all German Shepherds. But, I mean, that's obviously the stereotype of most of them, I think, are. Henry. Doesn't sound too...
That's not very intimidating, is it?
No. What would you change that to?
Imagine you're on patrol in Northbridge and there's a crook running away. It's like, get him, Henry.
Henry. No. What about Jaden?
Is that one of them?
No, it should be, though. I think we rename Henry.
Jaden.
Yeah. Don't you reckon?
It's a popular name. That is a very random suggestion.
Well, what's your suggestion?
Oh, it'd be something like Dagger or something tough, Saber. You know, something like that.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough.
Like Jaden. Jaden.
Well, if they've gone with Henry.
Wow.
They just, some of these just, it just sounds a little bit, I don't know, it sounds a bit Western. Henry and Leo sound a bit Western suburbs to me.
Yeah.
I think they need to be of the people.
Wow.
Get up with the names that are being used.
This has gone to places that I wasn't expecting. Maddie, thank you so much for this morning. We'll talk to you
tomorrow. Doesn't that just sum up this segment? Have a good one, mate.
You're listening to The West Live.
It's shaping up to be a massive week in Canberra, with a new COVID variant to deal with, a looming election, and workplace culture back in the spotlight. To take us through it all is The West Australian's federal politics editor, the one and only Lani Scar. G'day, Lani.
Good morning.
Let's start with the border situation. What can you tell us about the Morrison government's plans so far around Omicron?
Yeah, Omicron, which sounds like a Bond villain, doesn't it? So, look, the last night the government had a meeting of the National Security Cabinet. It went for quite some time. They decided in that meeting that they would pause the reopening of the international border for non-residents, so people who were coming in on student visas, on humanitarian visas, from certain countries as well. They decided that they would pause that, and they're going to pause it for 2 weeks. So it was due to open on December 1. They've delayed that until December 15, so they can get the scientific data around this new villain variant of coronavirus and determine whether it is going to be as big of a threat as, you know, as some people are concerned about.
I spoke to a leading epidemiologist yesterday on the show who said we might not have a lot to worry about when it comes to Omicron, and there's certainly some early feedback coming out of Southern Africa that the cases have been fairly mild in terms of the symptoms. Is there a feeling that the federal government is just operating out of an abundance of caution, but they might be hopeful that this might not be a sort of a doom and gloom scenario?
Yeah, well, the Chief Health Officer, Paul Kelly, said yesterday in the press conference in the Blue Room here at Parliament House, he said it would be his Christmas present if essentially this variant of the virus isn't as, you know, isn't as strong or deadly as other variants. So, I think, look, we're going into an election year. We all have had a very tough 18 months. So the government doesn't want to mess around and make any mistakes when we are on the precipice of, you know, going back to somewhat some kind of normal, that they don't want to mess it up. So I think it is the right balance to delay it for 2 weeks to get the health data and then come up with a decision based on that. I really think it is sensible. We are going to have a meeting of National Cabinet this afternoon. That's going to be starting at 4:30 Eastern time. So it will be interesting to see what comes out of that meeting of National Cabinet. We know premiers like our own, Mark McGowan, have, had different views to premiers like Dominic Perrottet and those others in the eastern states. So I think it'll be interesting to see where we land following that meeting and if there are any changes to the domestic plan.
Yeah, absolutely. I just hope that Christmas present remark ages well. And now let's talk about the election. You had a story on the front page of The West today that ScoMo had set a date for the federal budget. That's usually a pretty good indicator of when we might expect a federal election. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so look, the budget next year is actually going to be on my birthday. So, I look forward to our listeners sending me lots of birthday cards now. March 29 is when the budget is going to be. The sitting schedule was put to the Parliament yesterday. Now, look, it's important to note, this can always change. So whilst, yes, the budget is, in the schedule for March, the end of March, whilst, yes, it looks likely that then that means we'll follow the same playbook as the 2019 election when there was an early budget and then we went to an election shortly afterwards in May. Whilst it looks like that, anything can change. The government can change things. So it's our best indication yet, but, elections are always full of surprises.
Yeah, definitely. And so supposing it does go down as it is at the moment with this budget handed down at the end of March, what do you think the federal government would be hoping to get out of that budget? Something where they're giving people a lot of tax breaks, a lot of bonuses, a few carrots thrown around?
Yeah, look, it's interesting because my column today in the paper talks about some feedback that I've been getting from a lot of people in the government, which is that they actually think whilst the 2019 election was the election of the quiet Australians, some of them think that this election is going to be the election based on the women's vote. So we might see a lot of things in the budget in relation to that, but you would expect that the government is going to want to show fiscal prudence. They're going to show that they're responsible fiscal managers. So it may not be a big spending spree because they're not going to want to have that perception in the election. I think budgets always have sweeteners in them for the public, particularly budgets that are on the eve of an election.
Well, we're talking about how the federal government might relate to female voters, and there's a review into workplace culture at Parliament House that's due to be handed down today. That is going to be massive. We've seen a lot of issues coming out of Parliament over the past 12 months and dating before that. What are you expecting to see in this report?
Yeah, look, I mean, what I've been told is that it is what we all expect, which is that it is going to be pretty bad. It's what Sex Discrimination Commissioner Kate Jenkins was tasked to do after the allegations from Brittany Higgins of her allegedly being raped in Parliament House by a former colleague were aired. So, look, that's the feedback I've got. The government got the report yesterday. It was handed to Finance Minister Simon Birmingham. Labor was then briefed on the report along with the Greens, and also Brittany Higgins herself was briefed on it yesterday, is my understanding. And then what will happen now is that it will be put to Parliament today and we'll, all get the opportunity to read it and report on it. There will be a number of recommendations from that. It's important to note the government has already put some things in place following the revelations, the alleged revelations from Brittany Higgins. So, it will definitely shine a spotlight on that issue again. Earlier in the year when this all came out, it definitely felt like there was a dark cloud hanging over Parliament House in relation to this. So, you know, I'm sure it'll bring those emotions back for some people, but hopefully we can have some positive outcomes and actually have Parliament House be a safer and better place for all people to work in.
Yeah, which I think is something that everybody wants to see. And certainly that's the expectation of everybody outside of Canberra in our seat of power. But I'm curious to know, like, so in much of this debate, it's really been centred around Liberal staffers, Liberal Party officers. Do you think this review will reveal anything about the other political parties and what the cultures within their organisations might be?
I think it absolutely will, because staffers and parliamentarians and people who work on all sides of Parliament were, you know, interviewed for this review. And I think it's important to note this is not just a problem within the government. This is a problem across all areas of Parliament and all parties in Parliament. It's about the culture in Parliament House. So, yeah, I think it will, you know, it will look at all of that. I think, and obviously I haven't seen the report yet, but I think the Sex Discrimination Commissioner, Kate Jenkins, will, you know, will want to appear non-partisan. So I don't think she will be skewering any particular side of politics. She'll be talking about how we can, you know, make Parliament a safer place for all people who work here, regardless of their political stripes.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And we're lucky to have you reporting on it. The West Australian's Federal Politics Editor, Lani Scar, thanks as always for joining us on The West Live.
Thanks for having me.
With everything happening with COVID last week, you may have missed a bill which was introduced before Parliament, which is set to have massive ramifications for the Aboriginal people of WA. But what makes this worse is that it came as a shock to the very people who've been consulting on the Aboriginal Cultural Heritage Bill. Joining me now is Yamachi Noongar woman and Green Senator Dorinda Cox. Good morning, Dorinda.
Good morning.
And so let's have a chat about this Aboriginal Cultural Heritage Bill. What is the point of the legislation?
Well, the point of the legislation is supposed to be to protect the Aboriginal cultural heritage that exists in Western Australia.
And do you think it's going to do that?
Unfortunately, it's not. And one of the biggest issues is that, you know, we've had a Joint Select Committee inquiry into the Juukan Gorge and the blowing up of the rock shelters there. You know, they're 46,000 years old and we were unable to protect them under the previous legislation, which is the 1972 Aboriginal Heritage Act. This new piece of legislation doesn't follow any of the key principles of the recommendations from that inquiry, which I've raised both with the Premier Western Australia, but also with Minister Stephen Dawson directly, mainly around the free, prior, informed consent issue and the right to veto on country. And the process of that really is that Aboriginal people in Western Australia should have the right to say when and where development and extractive industries happens on their country in order to protect cultural heritage that exists for them.
Mm. And so the McGowan government introduced this bill into the WA Parliament late last week. And did they give traditional owners the chance to have a look at the final version before bringing it into Parliament?
Definitely not. So we have been requesting a copy of this bill, as the other 70 you know, prescribed body corporates that exist across Western Australia and traditional owner groups have been asking the state government to produce a draft piece of legislation that they could provide feedback on before it was presented to the Parliament, and that was declined. At a recent meeting in the Kimberley, the Minister did give an undertaking to the traditional owners of the Kimberley that they would be provided with a copy of it. It was in fact put on the website only 24 hours before the draft bill was actually introduced, which to me is a lie. You know, you can't run around in the country and say we're going to work with traditional owners and with Aboriginal people in this state and then not even provide a copy of the draft legislation. It's just ridiculous, you know?
it's kind of breathtaking to me that you'd even contemplate doing a bill that is ostensibly meant to protect the most sacred places of our First Nations people, but then not even show them the bill before you enter it into Parliament. You have to wonder then what the motivation behind it is. And so what are you thinking then? Because obviously the flip side of this legislation is who is asking for the government to allow development or the use of the land. And of course, it's mining companies that we're talking about.
That's right. And so, I mean, I've been referring to this as a mining enabling bill. What this does is enable them to fast track their approvals. This enables the minister in its current form to overturn any decisions. So the minister has the final say. So if the traditional owner groups say, no, we don't want mining on this country, we need to protect the cultural heritage of these sites, the minister can overturn that and say, in the benefit of West Australian people, for cultural or social benefit, he can overturn that decision and he has the final say. There isn't even a right of appeal included in that. So that has also been removed from the bill because the minister wanted it in that way, which says to you that's for me complete arrogance. You know, how does the government and the minister in particular say that they want to work with Aboriginal people in our state and then remove any right of appeal, but also remove consent from us? It just doesn't, it doesn't sit well with me. I was curious to hear that the government didn't take on board any of the recommendations from the Joint Select Committee, that they didn't listen to Aboriginal people in the state, and that basically they just went right ahead and did whatever they wanted to.
Yeah, it does seem that they ran roughshod over everything. And what you mentioned there, talking about removing the right for First Nations people to appeal to the State Administrative Tribunal, any decision made by the government when it comes to the use of the land. Senior Counsel Greg McIntyre, who's been on the show before and listeners will know as the lawyer who fought for Eddie Mabo and basically helped to enshrine land rights in this Australian law, he said that removing that right to appeal basically is tantamount to racial discrimination against Indigenous people. Would you agree?
Absolutely. What that does is remove any of our basic human rights. So in the article of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which Australia is a signatory to, Article 31 is very, very clear that we have the right to be able to protect cultural heritage. They're our basic human rights. And, you know, being enshrined in a declaration like that, the principle of that should be upheld by all governments in this country. And to actually not do that is a basis for racial discrimination. So, Mr. McIntyre is absolutely, on point with that comment. Not having the right of appeal, and this is stuff that I've raised with the government, you know, is how we uncovered things like robo-debt, you know, at a Commonwealth level, that having the right of appeal allows people to exercise that, allows the critique of systems and decisions that are made by governments, because they're not always watertight, they're not always found in the best interests of people, and so there has to be a right of appeal. And to actually breach that based on Aboriginal cultural heritage is removing our human rights in relation to that.
Now, Dorinda, we've seen the McGowan government use its supermajority to push through electoral reform. There's nothing really stopping it to push this through either, but nothing is set in stone yet. So what would you like to say to Mark McGowan when it comes to this Aboriginal Heritage Bill?
I would love to say to him that he should stop this process right now. Continuing with this process is only going to create division in the community. The Commonwealth Government have announced yesterday a National Aboriginal Cultural Heritage Alliance, which will be chaired by Mr. Cato Muir, who is a West Australian, who is also the National Native Title Chair for our council. And so, you know, the Commonwealth are wanting to provide that leadership. I've spoken directly to Minister Wyatt here in Canberra only last week about this issue, that when we have Commonwealth providing that federal leadership in this issue, the states and territories then need to follow suit. So harmonising that at a Commonwealth level and getting a federal framework for that is the priority and should be the priority. And so by halting any further progression of this bill is absolutely paramount at this point. And so Mr. McGowan should stop that process.
Yep. I think there's something that they need to listen to. Absolutely. Now, before I let you go, Dorinda, Australia lost a screen icon this week, David Gulpilil, who has left such a huge legacy on Australian cinema. What did he mean to Aboriginal people?
Well, he was iconic in lots of the films that David appeared in. And, you know, for us, it's the cultural component. It is the social component in having an icon, a screen icon like that, leave us so suddenly. That legacy that he's left behind, though, is just amazing. And, we will continue to remember that legacy that he's left behind.
Yeah, absolutely. Green Senator for WA, Nyamuchi Noongar woman, Dorinda Cox, thanks for joining us and sharing your insights on The West Live.
Great, thanks, Ben.
And now a warning for our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners. You're about to hear the voice of someone who is now deceased. It goes for just over 10 seconds if you want to skip over it.
Mick, you frightened shit out of me.
So I ought to, mate. Sneaking up on a man when he's rendering first aid to a lady.
Is that what you were doing?
He's been described as a once-in-a-generation actor. His impact on Australian film extends far beyond his acting, though. If you've watched Australian classics like Crocodile Dundee or Rabbit Proof Fence, you've seen the acting legend David Dalatingu. His family have now asked for his previous name not to be used for the time being in accordance with Yolngu mourning traditions. The screen legend lost a 4-year battle with lung cancer yesterday, and a man who knows him very well, his biographer Derek Riley, joins us now. Good morning, Derek.
Hello, Ben.
So firstly, how will you be remembering David?
I'll be remembering David as probably the most beautiful man I've ever seen up close. But also, you know, for me, I did the book because I had done a book with Bob Hawke, and I thought the other great living Australian at the time was David Gulpilil, you know, our greatest actor, and, you know, a living connection to 60,000 years of continuous culture and, you know, that great bridge between black and white Australia.
Yeah, well, that was the thing with David, wasn't it? Like, he really did walk in two worlds. He was always very connected to his Yolngu people of Arnhem Land, but as he found fame, and he did find incredible fame, like in the documentary My Name is Gulpilil, he talked about dining with the Queen in London. Just how big of a celebrity did he become?
Well, you have to walk, because The Walkabout was a massive success, and I think it's still one of the, you know, 50 greatest British films ever made, even though it's, you know, obviously an Australian setting. And he became such an overnight success. You know, he did dine with the Queen of Buckingham Palace, and I actually spoke to David about a story that he speared one of the ducks in the pond. And you never tell David whether it was true or not, but he was pretty convincing that he speared a duck in the Queen's pond. But yeah, so he actually, you know, went to parties with Bob Marley and John Lennon and Jimi Hendrix in London, and he had a wild old time. And you know, David loved being a movie star, and of all the sort of celebrities I've interviewed or been near to, he's one person who loves the camera more than anyone. And even when he was very sick, you know, he wouldn't be very animated, but then turn the camera on, boom, he'd just come into life. He just loved the camera and he ate it up.
Yeah, I know, you're right. I've interviewed him a couple of times and also interviewed Molly Reynolds, who made that documentary that I just mentioned. And she spent time with him when he really was quite crook living in South Australia. And she basically said exactly what you did, that when the cameras were rolling, it was like he was himself again. As soon as they stopped, you could really see the impact of that illness. I'm curious to know, like, in your opinion, just what sort of a legacy do you think he leaves, both in terms of Australian cinema and for Aboriginal people in this country?
I think cinema-wise, I think he should be a case where every actor should study Gulpilil. When I meet actors now, they say, you know, who do I like? So you have to watch two pivotal scenes in Charlie's Country. One is the opening scene where David receives a letter and he's in his humpy. There's no words spoken. When he opens this letter, he inspects it, puts his glasses on, and just does all these, you know, he talks with his face without opening his mouth, you know, and he says so much purely by his incredible acting, and then shortly after that he walks up the road and it's during the intervention and starts yelling at the cop station that they brought alcohol, and drugs and all these things in their communities and have ruined them. And then the cop comes out and he goes, "G'day, Charlie," and Double goes, "G'day, Luke." And it's just this beautiful moment where the cop is just totally oblivious to the damage and the destruction wrought on, you know, Aboriginal culture and lives, but there's still this beautiful moment and this connection between two human beings. And I think that's David's role as a bridge between black and white, because, you know, Walkabout was the first time that an Aboriginal person was, you know, perceived as strong and capable. And, you know, he was 16 when he played the character, and he, you know, saves two European kids while destroying himself in the process.
Mm. And now, you wrote his biography, and he loves telling a story. There's no doubt about that. Can you give us an idea of what the process of writing the book involved? Because I know, having spoken to him a couple of times, he never really were quite sure where the truth was, but David never let that get in the way of a good yarn.
It didn't really matter. The best stories actually came from other people because they were fairly true. But the process was, so I wrote the book around the same time that Molly was making the documentary, and her husband and partner, Rolf De Heer, put me in contact, and he said, "Mate, you'd be lucky to get 12 words out of it." I think a little more than 12, but not too much more. But generally, when I went down there, so I live in Sydney, he lives in Murray Bridge, South Oz, and I'd fly down there, drive to his house, and we'd just hang out. You know, I tried to interview him quite formally initially, but the best moments of the interaction between him and his carer, Mary Hood, and I like this hilarious, bickering old couple. And so I would, you know, take notes of all that. And, you know, sometimes we'd watch a movie together. We'd watch the Tracker together. And as we were watching it, you know, he started to sort of go in and out of sleep, I guess, because he was on opioids for his lung cancer. And sort of watching it, and there's this pivotal scene, and he sort of nods off, and he comes back, and he goes, "David Gopalil." And he falls back sort of asleep again, and he goes, "Movie star." and then he comes up again and he holds up his four fingers, because he only has four because he lost half a finger when a 44-gallon drum fell on it back when he was about 20. And he holds his four fingers up and he goes, "David Gopalil, 5 stars.
he was a character. Like, they certainly broke the mold when they made him. And you mentioned The Tracker, which is a great Aussie film, starring also Gary Sweet, who you spoke to in the course of doing the biography. You also spoke to some other people who collaborated with David over the years: Jack Thompson, Paul Hogan, of course, Philip Noyce. What did all of those people have in common when they were describing David?
Everyone, you know, to a man and to a woman, it was his greatness, because as an actor, he's just a great actor. I guess he's our Marlon Brando. And they all spoke about how when the camera on, boom, he's on. He doesn't have to do anything. He's him. But, you know, Damon Gamma, actually, who has made a few documentaries about, you know, environmentalist documentaries, his life has changed by his experience on The Tracker.
Mm.
With, because they filmed in the Flinders Ranges, and it was all on location for 6 weeks, and, you know, David just held court for 6 weeks, and then Damon Gallo went and visited David in Ramagini, his community in Arnhem Land, and it changed his life, you know, for the next 15 or 16 years, whatever it is, 20 years, his life has been devoted to environmentalism purely because of his experience with David.
Yeah, and it reminds me to encourage everybody listening today to track down David's films, actually watch them, and I think you get a great connection to country. You understand how that connection to country works for Aboriginal people, and also I think you get a great insight into the Aboriginal experience in Australia, which has often been one that has been pretty hard to live through. I think it's informative, I think it's entertaining, I think Australia absolutely lost one of the great ones this week. Biographer Derek Riley, thanks for joining us and helping us remember this great man on The West Live.
Thank you, man.
The game, Cricket Tipping, is here. It's the free cricket tipping competition that's easy to play. Just sign up now for your chance to win 15 grand for being the season's top tipper. Plus, there's weekly cash prizes of $1,000. The cricket season starts this Sunday, so don't miss out. Sign up now for free at thegame.com.au.
The Wild West.
Joining me now in the studio is Perth Now editor Nat Richards. G'day, Nat.
Good morning. How are you?
You're pretty good. I'm actually concerned for you, being someone of English heritage, that summer is here.
Are you saying I'm pasty and pale, then? Because if you were saying that, you'd be absolutely right. Yes, summer is officially here. It is way too stinking hot for me already.
But hang on, do you fall
back to 50 is out.
Do you fall into that category of Poms who, you know, despite maybe having a complexion that's not suited for our sunny summers, still go out there and just get roasted like a lobster?
I used to have this thing called Factor 8 sun cream. It exists, right? I used to use it and my God, oh, I had a tan. I went red and then I tanned, but God, it's not healthy, is it? It's not healthy at all. And it doesn't tell you what that stuff's like, cooking oil over here. So, no, it's back to 50 only in our house now. We're both pasty and white and we'll probably stay that way all summer. My husband's got two shades. He's red and white. So, yeah, he's already got the tradie tan going
on. Do you think things are changing? Because obviously we all know about melanomas, skin cancer, and how dangerous it is. You think that message is now well and truly established out there in society?
Well, people are getting vitamin D deficiencies.
You still see lots of people, you know, really just baking themselves in the sun.
You do, but there's so many good spray tans nowadays and home tanning methods, and they work better. And better for your skin, and you don't have to sweat away. But I think it's just a nice feeling of going out and having the sun on you, isn't it?
What do you think about warm summer nights? Do you have air conditioning?
I do have air conditioning, and I used to live in a house that only had it in the living room. My God, we got to the point where, and it was one of these open plans, because Australians, everything's open plan, right? You don't shut rooms off. So we had a room that we couldn't shut off, so we used to get a mattress, use it to create a door and sleep in the living room to try and trap all the cold air in, because you just could not sleep. Wow. But that's the thing, is that we're in for another hot week this week. So it's going to be, it'd be nice and, you know, just nice temperatures during the week, you know, 26, 24,
nice,
25.
Lovely.
Optimal temperature for me. Then you're going to get into Friday, right? And this is Christmas party territory, Ben, for us. So Friday, 32 degrees. Saturday, 35. Ooh. Sunday, 35. Ooh. And overnight on Sunday, 21 degrees.
Yeah, that's hot.
Do you have an optimal temperature for overnight?
Well,
what do you set your aircon to?
I would probably set my aircon for 23. But
what?
Yeah, I have it for 23.
Ben, that's ridiculous. 23?
Yeah.
What is wrong with you?
What do you set it for?
20 or less.
That's
all the time.
Freezing.
20 is too hot for me. Like,
that's cold.
20
but
or less.
Then you're under a doona, right?
Yeah, but so you have to be under the duvet.
There's something just wrong about that. You can't sleep under a doona in summer.
Yeah, you've got to be, I call it a duvet. I can't say a doona, I'm sorry. But under a duvet, I go under a duvet, right, and I have my 20 degrees or less. I cannot have it any hotter than that. My husband puts it on 24 because he says it's the most efficient, right? He's an engineer, so he's into all this. It says 24 is perfect, efficient temperature. Way too hot. Cannot sleep in that.
Yeah, wow.
No chance.
Wow. Well, look, if there were more people out there like you, it would be underwater for the global warming.
Well, I'm sorry. Sorry to the planet, but I'm keeping my aircon cranked. It's safer for everybody, put it that
35.
Way,
if I get I've got sleep. A bet going. I've got a bet going
Go
with
on.
My daughter about what the hottest temperature this summer is going to be.
Right, what's
she can have. She can have anything above 41, but if it doesn't get higher than 41.0, then I win the bet.
And what do you get?
I think we said $20. Which is big, big money.
Quite a lot.
For a journalist and a 10-year-old.
Yeah, I'm going to say quite a lot for a journalist.
And now, talking about summer, like so one beautiful thing about summer in Perth is hitting up the beer gardens.
Mm.
There's a number of them in Perth now. Some of them are really, really awesome. And most of them have those, like, a little plumbed systems, little pipes going around near the roof, and they mist water coming out. But I hear that maybe these misting systems could be a bit dangerous.
Well, according to ECU, there's actually pathogens living in some of those pipes. So obviously, you're not going to use a mister on a hot day,
Omicron?
Right?
Is it Omicron?
It's not Omicron. God, who knows? That'll be next. So don't start that rumour, Ben. So in these pipes, it's spewing out. You're using it in hot weather. So it's making the water inside those pipes get quite warm. When it's getting warm, apparently it's breeding ground
breeding
for germs.
Bacteria
and then it's
and stuff.
What you do, you switch it on and it spews it all out at everybody and it just goes all airborne. They're saying that this could lead to, you know, quite serious illnesses in people. It could spread things around, particularly for elderly people.
And like Legionella. That's one of the things that lives in that sort of water, like air conditioning water and stuff.
Apparently it can be spread around from it. So, I mean, some of this water is chlorinated, but like, it gets very hot in the pipe. So that's the theory, is that it's creating a bit of a breeding ground for all these nasty bugs. One thing I will say as well, we've got them in our back garden. They are a pain in the arse. A pain in the ass to maintain, because you cannot get them right. They either drip, right?
Yeah,
and that's really irritating because you create these puddles, or there's one that doesn't work and you've got to CLR it. It's just every time you switch it on, one's not working, one's dripping. It's just not worth the effort. Just go inside. Just not worth it.
I don't actually like being spritzed with water all the time. Mm. Like when I'm in a pub, I'm just like, it's,
it
I don't think
it your
makes
makeup
that much
as a
of a,
woman too.
And your hair,
yes.
The extra humidity make your hair go frizzy. So there you go. I never thought that I could get Legionella from them, but I can see it though, you know. Like you think if a pub, you know, sort of closes on Sunday night and then might not reopen till Wednesday, the water's been sitting in there for a few days, and then if you're the first one in there on Wednesday for lunch and the water's coming out squirting on you, ugh.
I tell you they do feel refreshing when they're working, but I don't know. Not a fan. Not a fan.
All right. And so, do you know what? It's amazing. Since Trump lost the presidential election, I really rarely think of American politics anymore. Don't you think?
It used to be
something that we would talk about daily.
I remember when Trump won the election and we were talking through here and people were going, oh, God, no. Oh, God, no. And we were saying, no, it's brilliant. Imagine the mileage we'll get out of this as a journalist. Yeah. It's going to be great
Every single day we would talk about something.
Yes. I mean, granted, the world's going to end. But, you know, imagine what fun we're going to have as a journalist. And now it's all a bit boring, isn't it? And that, I think, has been reflected this year in the Christmas decorations too. So Melania was very OTT when it came to, because the First Lady's traditional job to decorate the White House.
Literally the only thing that she did.
Was decorate the White House. But the Trumps were very OTT. They had Trump Towers, of course. So they do everything. Like, they don't do things by halves. Neither do Americans in general, really. But it was spectacular. And it was very divisive. I mean, she had do you remember those blood red Christmas trees she had down a hallway? Like umpteen of them in a row. It was all a bit creepy.
Not very classy.
But they were very in your face. Now Jill Biden's come in. And she's tried to inject a bit of class into the whole thing. But it's all very boring.
Is it?
And it's the issue that's divided Americans, right? Stand by, because there's not much colour on these Christmas trees.
We can bring up a
there's
picture
just, like,
of these,
white,
Mel, while we're talking about it.
White doves. What white? White doves. Mm. It's very angelic.
Interesting.
It's all a bit boring. There's no red. There's no Christmassy touch to it.
Well, do you know why?
Because
it's because Jill Biden would have been doing it and going, oh, Joe, what do you reckon? He's like asleep in the corner.
Yeah, whatever. Just you do
or,
it.
Or
love.
Letting one rip, just like he did in front of Camilla.
So, and the thing is as well, they do have this very sweet bauble, though. I will give them that. It's got a picture of them both in it, which is very cute. A picture of the First Lady and the President. Are you looking at the pictures now?
I'm looking at the pictures now. Do you know what it reminds me of?
Go on.
That, to me, looks like a Meyer or a David Jones. You know, it looks like a department store.
It's not.
There's no sort
presidential.
Of personal touch. It's not. No, it's not. It doesn't look opulent. And there's a little.
I'm sorry, but the Trumps did it better. I'm calling it. When it comes to Christmas, the Trumps did it better.
Controversial. Have you put up your Christmas tree yet?
I have not, because I don't think you should put them up until Christmas. What is it?
What do you mean? You mean
Christmas is December to me, right?
Okay. Yeah.
That's from tomorrow onwards.
Yeah.
Don't put them
up. I was having this discussion with my producer, Mel. She likes to go like 2 weeks, 2 weeks out from December.
And with you, Mel. And I don't understand these people.
No, 2 weeks out from December. So she did it 2 weeks ago.
Oh, 2 weeks out from December? Oh, no, 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 no. I know somebody in my team who put theirs up and it was up on Halloween. Like, what even is that?
Wow.
Like, it's not Christmas. Christmas
and
is
December.
And what
do they put under there? Some hot cross buns for the next Easter?
Don't get it. I don't get it. It's Bryce Wolf in Creative Giver comes on here. Name and shame.
You've been outed.
No, in our house, it'll go up this weekend after the Christmas party when I'm feeling a bit worse for wear, and we'll put up the Christmas tree.
And what do you do ornaments-wise? Because there's two schools of thought for ornaments. You can either make it like a sort of a sophisticated of thing, or you can make it a personalised, like ornaments that mean something
to you.
Yeah,
we do that. We buy a special ornament every year.
That's
Jonathan,
what we do.
An idea? I think it's more and more expensive every bloody year as well. So we've got expensive, nice ornament each every year. And then, just whatever comes out of the box first.
Do you know, we got a coronavirus ornament last year.
Did you?
Because we thought, how are we going to remember 2020? I know, coronavirus ornament. And then we'll never talk about coronavirus ever again.
Here we go, 2021. What's your ornament this year?
Haven't got it yet.
Haven't you? I've got a George Jensen one, me.
Oh, that's very fancy.
And my husband's got a polar bear on skis. So
I like to try and sum up the year somehow, but it's hard to find newsy Christmas ornaments.
So you never switch off, do you, Ben? Always a journal.
Yeah, exactly. And Nat Richards, absolute pleasure talking to you as always. We'll speak to you again soon.
Thanks, Ben. Ta-ra.
Well, that's it from me. Glad to have your company. I'll be back tomorrow live from 8:45 a.m. You can download the full show or individual interviews by searching for The West Live wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to The West Live with Ben O'Shea. If the story behind the story matters to you, then you can count on thewest.com.au to deliver.